Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks. When she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. Hello and welcome back to the Gloomy Star Podcast. I'm your host, Henry Bilbrey. And today, I'll be telling you the story of Lizzie Borden. Was an American woman tried and acquitted for the August 4, 1892 axe murders of her father and stepmother in Fall River, Massachusetts. No one else was charged in the murders, and despite something from other residents, Borden spent the remainder of her life in Fall River. She died of pneumonia at age 66. Just days before her death, her sister Emma. The murders and trial received widespread publicity around the United States and along with Borden herself. They remain a topic in the American pop culture to the present day. They have been depicted in numerous films, theatrical productions, literary work, and folk rhymes, and still very well known in the Fall River area. Lizzie Andrew Borden was born July 19, 1860 in Fall River, Massachusetts, to Sarah Anthony and Andrew Jackson Borden. Her father was an English and Welsh descent, grew up in a very modest surroundings, and struggled financially as a young woman. Despite being the descent of a wealthy and influential local resident, he eventually proposed to manufacture and sell furniture and caskets, then became a successful property developer. He was a director of several textile firms and owned considerable commercial property. He was also president for the Union Savings Bank and a director of the Durfee Safe Deposit and Trust Company. At his death, his estate was valued at $300,000, equivalent to $9 million today. Despite his wealth, Andrew was known for his frugality. For instance, the Borden home lacked indoor plumbing, although there was a common accommodation for wealthy families at the time. It was an affluent area, but the wealthiest residents of Fall River, including Andrew's cousins, generally lived in more fashionable neighborhoods. The Hill, which was from the farther areas of the city, and much more homogeneous radically, ethically, and sociomatically. Borden and her older sister, Emma, Leonora Borden, had a relatively religious upbringing and attended Central Congregational Church. As a young woman, she was very involved in church activities, including teaching Sunday school to children of recent immigrations to the United States. She was involved in Christian organizations such as the Christian Endeavor Society, for which she was served as Secretary of Treasurer, and contemporary social movements such as Women's Christian Temperance Union. She was also a member of the Ladies' Fruit and Flower Mission. 3 years after the death of Lizzie Borden's mother, Sarah Andrew married Abby Gerfew Gray. Lizzie stated that she called her stepmother Miss Borden and demurred on whether they had a cardinal relationship. She believed that Abby had married her father for his wealth. Bridget Sullivan, who they called Maggie, the Borden's 25-year-old live-in maid, who had immigrated to the United States from Ireland, testified that Lizzie and Emma rarely ate meals with their parents. In May 1892, Andrew killed multiple pigeons in his barn with a hatchet, believing that they were attracting local children to hunt them. Lizzie had recently built a roost for the pigeons, and it had been commonly recorded that she was upset over him killing them. Though the velocity of this has been disputed, family argument on July 1892 prompted both sisters to extend vacations, in quotes, in that she was upset over his killing of them. Through the veracity of this has been disputed, a family argument, in New Bedford. After returning to Fall River a week before the murders, Lizzie chose to stay at a local rooming house for 4 days before returning to the family residence. That seems like a lot over some birds. That's pretty mad over some birds. I don't know. I know this was a few hundred years ago, but I don't think I would get that mad over birds. Tension had been growing with the family in the months before the murders, especially over Andrew's gifts of real estate to various branches of Abby's family, and their stepmother's sister received a house. The sisters had demanded and received a rental property, the home that they lived in until their mother died, which was purchased from their father for $1. A few weeks before the murders, they sold the property back to their father for $5,000, equivalent to $144,000 today. The night before the murders, John Victim Morris, the brother of Lizzie and Emma's deceased mother, visited and was invited to stay for a few days for to discuss business matters with Andrew's writers have speculated that their conversation, particularly about property transfer, may have aggravated a already tense situation. For several days before the murders, the entire household had been violently ill. A family friend later speculated that mutton left on the stove to use in meals over several days was the cause. But Abby had feared poisoning, and Andrew had not been a popular man. The murders. August 4th, 1892. John Morris arrived the evening of August 3rd and slept in the guest room that night. After breakfast the next morning, at which Andrew, Abby, Lizzie, Morris, and the Bordens, Maid Bridget, Maggie, Sylvan were present. Andrew and Morris went to the sitting room. They chatted for nearly an hour. Morris left around 8:48 to buy a pair of oxen and to visit his niece in Fall River. Planning to return to the Borden home for lunch at noon, Andrew left for his morning walk sometime after 9. Although the cleaning of the guest room was one of Lizzie's and Emma's regular chores, Abby went upstairs sometime between 9 a.m. and 10:30 and to make the bed. According to the forensic investigation, Abby was facing the killer at the time of the attack. She was first struck on the side of the head with a hatchet, which cut her above the ear, causing her to turn and fall face down to the floor, creating conscious on her craters on her nose and forehead. Her killer struck her multiple times, delivering 17 more direct hits on the back of her head, killing her. When Andrew returned around 10:30, his key failed to open the door, so he knocked for attention. Sylvan went to unlock the door, finding it jammed. She uttered an She would later testify that she heard Lizzie laughing immediately after this. She did not see Lizzie, but stated that the laughter was coming up from the top of the stairs. This was considered significant, as Abby was already dead by this time, and her body would not have been visible for anyone in the home on the second floor. Lizzie later denied being upstairs and testified that her father had asked her where Abby was, and she replied with the message her dad had. She replied that a message had delivered Abby a messenger had delivered Abby a summons to visit a sick friend. Lizzie stated that she had removed Andrew's boots and was helping him into his slippers before he laid down on the sofa for a nap. She then informed Sullivan of the department store sale and permitted her to go, but Sullivan felt unwell and went to take a nap in her bedroom instead. Sullivan testified that she was in her third floor room, resting from cleaning windows, when just before 11:10, she heard Lizzie call from downstairs, "Maggie, come quick! Father's dead! Somebody came in and killed him!" Andrew was lumped on the couch in the downstairs sitting room, struck 10 or 11 times with a hatchet-like weapon. One of his eyeballs had been split clearly in two, suggesting that he had been asleep when attacked. His still bleeding wound suggested a very recent attack. Mr. Bowen, the family physician, arrived at the home from across the street to determine that both victims had died. Detectives estimated the death had occurred at approximately 11 o'clock. Lizzie Borden's initial answers to the police officers' questions were at times strange and contrary. Initially, she reported hearing a groan or a scraping noise or a distress call before entering the house. 2 hours later, she told police that she heard nothing and entered the house not realizing anything was wrong. When asked what her stepmother was, she recounted Abby receiving a note asking her to visit a sick friend. She also stated that she thought Abby had returned and asked if someone could go upstairs and look for her. Sullivan and a neighbor, Miss Churchill, were halfway up the stairs, their eyes level with the floor, when they looked to the guest room and saw Abby laying face down on the floor. Most of the officers who interviewed Borden reported that they disliked her attitude. Some said she was calm and possessed, despite her attitude and changing abyss. Nobody bothered to check her for bloodstains. Police did search her room, but it was a courtesy inspection. At the trial, they admitted it to not be a proper search because Borden was not feeling well. They were subsequently criticized for their lack of diligence. In the basement, police found two hatchets, two axes, and a hatchet head with a broken handle. The hatchet head was suspected to be the murder weapon, as the break in the handle appeared fresh in the ash dust on the head, unlike that of the other balded tools. The other balded tools appeared to have deliberately applied to make it look like it had been in the basement at the time. However, none of the tools were removed from the house, because all the mysterious illnesses that had stricken the household before the murders, the family's milk, the Andrews and Abby's stomachs, removing during the autopsies performed in the Borden living room, were tested for poison. None was found. Residents suspected Lizzie of purchasing hydronic acid in a diluted form from the local drugstore. She defended that she inquired about the acid so she could clean her furs. Lizzie and Emma's friend, Alice Russell, decided to stay with them that night following the murders, while the Morris spent the night in the attic guest room, contrary to the later accounts that he slept in the murder site guest room. Police were stationed around the house on the night of August 4th, during which the officers had seen Borden enter the cellar with Russell carrying a kerosene lamp and a stole pipe, a slop pail. He stated he saw a bunch of women exit the cellar, after which Borden returned alone. Though he was unable to see what she was doing, he stated it appeared that she was bent over the sink. On August 5th, Morris left the house and was mobbed by hundreds of people, police to escort him back to the house. On August 6th, police conducted a more thorough search of the house, inspecting the sister's clothing and confiscating the broken hinted hatchet head. The evening the police officer and the mayor visited the Bordens, and Lizzie was informed that she was a suspect for the murders. The next morning, Russell entered the kitchen to find Borden tearing up a dress. She explained that she was planning to put it in the fire because it was covered in paint. It was never determined whether the dress she was wearing the day of the murders. Really? You wouldn't check if someone said there was red paint after they were suspected for being murdered? Murdering someone? Did that not cross their mind? That doesn't make any sense to me. Inquest. Borden appeared at the inquest hearing on August 8th. Her request to have her family attorney present was refused under a state statute proving that an inquest must be held in private. She had been prescribed a regular dose of morphine to calm her nerves. It was possible that her testimony was affected by this. Her behavior was erratic, and she often refused to answer a question, even if the answer was beneficial to her. She often concentrated herself in providing alternate accounts of the morning in question, such as saying that she was in the kitchen reading a magazine when her father arrived home, then saying that she was in the dining room doing some ironing, and then saying she was coming down the stairs. She also said she had removed her father's boot and put his slippers on him, while police photographs clearly showed him wearing boots. The district attorney was very aggressive and confrontational. On August 11th, Borden was served with a warrant of arrest and jailed. The inquest attorney, the basis of the debate regarding her guilt or innocence was later ruled inadmissible as her trial in June 1893. The newspaper articles noted that Borden possessed a solid demeanor and a bit in her lips flushed the bent toward what? And bit her lips flushed and bent toward Attorney Adams. It was also reported that the testimony provides the inquest had caused a change of option among her friends, and she was therefore strongly maintained her innocence. The inquest received significant press attention nationwide, including extensive three-page written up in the Boston Globe. A grand jury began hearing evidence on November 7th in the Borden, and Borden was adjudicated on December 2nd. Trial and acquittal. Borden's trial took place in New Bedford starting on June 5th, 1893. Prosecuting attorneys were Hosea M. Knoenworth and future United States Supreme Court Justice William H. Moody. Defending were Andrew V. Jennings, Mullivan O. Adams, and former Massachusetts Governor George D. Robinson. 5 days before the trial's commencement, on June 1st, another axe murder occurred in Fall River. This time, the victim was Bertha Manchester, who was found hatched to death in her kitchen. The similarities between the Manchester and Borden's murders were striking and noted by jurors. However, Jose Corral de Mello, a Portuguese immigrant, was later convinced of Manchester's murder in 1894, and was determined not to have anything have been in the vicinity of Fall River at the time of the Borden murders. A prominent point of discussion in the trial or press coverage of it was the hatchet head found in the basement, which was not conceivably demonstrated by the prosecution to be the murder weapon. Prosecutors argued that the killer had removed the handle because it would have been covered in blood. One officer testified the hatchet handle was found near the hatchet head, but another officer disagreed with this and told the truth. Though no bloody clothing was found at the scene, Russell testified that on August 8th, 1892, she had witnessed Borden burn a dress in the kitchen stove, saying it had been ruined when she brushed against wet paint. During the course of the trial, defense never attempted to challenge the statement. Really? Go back to the dress again. That's like, did they not see that as evidence? Whatever. Lizzie Borden's presence at home was also a point of dispute. During the trial, according to testimony, Sullivan entered the second floor of the home around 10:58 a.m. and left Lizzie and her father downstairs. Lizzie told several people at this time she went to the barn and was not in the house. She was not in the house for 20 minutes or possibly half an hour. Hillman Lubisky testified for the defense as he saw Lizzie Borden leaving the barn at 11:03, and Charles Garner confirmed the time. At 11:10, Lizzie and Sullivan called Sullivan downstairs. He told Andrew, she told her Andrew had been murdered and ordered her not to enter the room. Borden sent her to get a doctor. Both victims' heads had been removed during autopsy, and the skulls were admitted as evidence during the trial and persisted on June 5th, 1893. Upon seeing them in the courtroom, Borden had fainted. Evidence was excluded the Bordens had to purchase prussic acid, cyanide, reportedly for cleaning a sealic cloak from the local druggist on the day before the murders. The judge ruled that the incident was too remote to have any connection. Really? So if you buy cyanide and the next day you're suspected for murdering someone, that's not a little sketchy? That doesn't seem really consistent here, but oh no, it's 1893. The pressing associate justice, Justin Dewey, who had been appointed by Robinson when he was governor, delivered a lengthy summary and supposed the defense of his charge to the jury before it was sent to deliberate on June 20th, 1893. After an hour and a half of deliberation, the jury acquitted Borden for all of the murders. Upon exiting the courthouse, she told reporters she was the happiest woman in the world, even though her family died less than a week ago. But I guess she's the happiest woman in the world. Whew. That is, odd. Thank you for listening today. That is going to wrap up this episode of the Gloomy Star Podcast. Remember, you're never alone. And see you next time. Goodbye. Today's episode is sponsored by Anchor, the easiest way to make a podcast. The sources for today's episode are Pinterest, Wikipedia, History.com, and The New York Times.